Well, last time Mr. Ekema left off, I think in verse 36 of Acts chapter 9, I was going to back up just for a moment here. It talks about a great miracle here that was done. I always want to say by Peter, but actually God's doing it, but Peter's the instrument at this particular point in verse 35. And we see Peter now heading back. He's been kind of touring the countryside here, and he's coming back to Joppa where he had been staying. And if you draw a line from Jerusalem northwest at about a 30-degree angle, it will pass through Lydda, where he just did the miracle, and it'll go right straight into Joppa by the sea. Joppa is right on the sea, and apparently this gentleman's home, here Simon the Tanner, lived right on the sea. And so that's where he's headed at this particular point. And we begin to see the story of Tabitha being beginning to unravel here. Her name is sometimes translated as Dorcas, but Tabitha is what Peter calls her. And Dorcas, or Tabitha, was full of good works. She was a woman of very charitable deeds in the church. She had done a lot for the brethren in that area. And here, I think it becomes very clear her love language was deeds of service. That's what she did. Someone constantly driven to serve other people. But sometimes in serving the sick and others, we can become weak ourselves in the process. And she, I don't know whether that was what caused her to die or not. You know, she overdid it maybe. I don't know. And so she became ill, and she died of it, whatever it was, in verse 37. And, of course, at this point in time in history, embalming was a very expensive process. They did it in Egypt and a few other places, but not in this area of the world, and it was thought to be unnecessary. So the custom was to simply wash the body clean and lay the person on a bed in their home. And then notify all the relatives and all of the friends, everyone who knew them, and they would come by to kind of, we would call it maybe a viewing of the body or whatever. That was kind of the process. But it had to be done pretty immediately because they didn't embalm the bodies back then either. So those individuals, when they knew it, you know, that someone had died, you had to move pretty quickly because it was going to be that day of the viewing, if it was possible, or at worst the next day if they happened to pass away at night or in the evening. Most people's families and friends all lived within short distances as well, so it was easy to contact them in a small town and to be able to be there. But as we see in verse 38, knowing that Peter is nearby, a couple of the disciples are sent to Joppa to fetch Peter, and they didn't want him to delay, probably because they weren't preserving the bodies for burial. They just needed to get the body in the ground within 48 hours. After 3 days, the body would begin to smell. So it was a very rapid turnaround process that was taking place. Then in verse 39, we see Peter went with them back to Lydda to the upper room where they had laid her. And all of this time, those mourning were talking of her works and good deeds and showing the tunics and the, you know, the things that she had sewn and made for the brethren. And this lady really loved and cared for the brethren, which brings to mind a question. If you or I died today, what would the brethren show or talk about at your funeral? It's an interesting question to look at. What would they say about you or me? What would they think about? It's always a possibility. We never know, you know, when our time comes, so to speak. We just don't know how long God is giving us. Would people comment on all the love you have shown for the brethren and all the things that you've done for them? Something to consider. Or would they be hard-pressed to come up with something to say? Hopefully not. Something to think about. You know, personal works and the things that we do, sometimes those are things for us to think about. even before Passover. You know, what is our I'm looking for the word, not our repertoire, legacy. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. What is our legacy? What will they remember about us? And of course, in verse 41, so Peter lifts up Dorcas and presents her alive to the widows and the brethren. Obviously, a very powerful resurrection by God here as a demonstration of who and what Peter and the disciples and the apostles are, and, you know, where he's working. And in verse 42, it becomes known throughout all Joppa. Joppa was the biggest city, or a bigger city than Lydda. Miracles always draw people's attention. But what are the lessons being taught here? Well, there's a number of things that are being taught or that are being shown. God is drawing attention to certain things and a demonstration of the authority of the apostles. Miracles draw attention, of course, to the one executing them, and God was doing that through Peter. Miracles strengthen the faith of some. Maybe not all the members, but it certainly strengthens the faith of some. Point number four is that resurrections in particular draw attention to the person being resurrected too. Why was this done? This was a servant of the church. The fifth reason, perhaps, God is showing his willingness to be seen interfering in human affairs and human events. God does intervene. And maybe the sixth reason might be that miracles often trigger the calling of individuals surrounding them by God. And it's focusing on the church and on those being called into the church in some way. So there's a lot of reasons why God would do these particular things. We don't know all of his reasons, but those are some of them. And I'm sure there's many more that I could probably list if I knew exactly why God did things, but we can only assume that we know. In verse 43, so Peter now stays many days in Joppa with Simon the Tanner. And why? Well, because of the miracles. There were a lot of people being drawn to the church at this point. So he's going to stay here because there's a lot of people coming into the church. There is a need for, if there weren't regular Sabbath services in the area, now there can be for some period of time. So the gospel was effectively being preached by Peter with the signs that were drawing people to the church. And in the Jewish community, someone who was a tanner was not always very well received. The reason being is they handled bodies of mostly dead animals. And they were tanning and, you know, dealing with the hides and other things as well. Their work involved dealing with dead bodies, and that's something that most Jewish people did not want to be defiled by touching bodies, because then they couldn't go to the temple. You know, there were various reasons they didn't like that or didn't want to be in touch with a tanner or living with a tanner, yet Peter's living with a tanner. So Peter has grown, shall we say, in terms of his understanding of how God works and works in the lives of people. The Jews felt that if you were tanner, you were ceremonially or commonly unclean by the fact that you were touching the bodies. And that's important because we're going to get to that whole concept here in the next couple of chapters, where Peter's going to learn even more than he understood before. So if you're going to the temple to pray, you would not want to have shaken hands with someone who was a tanner, or touched them, or be involved in their home. So in light of chapter 10, it's coincidental in some ways that Peter is staying with a tanner. He may not know exactly why yet, but he's about to find out. And that pretty much ends chapter 10. Any questions about chapter 10? I'm sorry, chapter 9. We're moving into 10. So, No questions. All right. Let me give a quick introduction to chapter 10. Chapters 10 and 11 actually mark a very important turning point in the book of Acts. Up until this point, the gospel has been primarily taught to the Jews, but we are about to see it going to the Gentiles, and there is a major lesson in terms of clean and unclean foods that is delivered by Peter's story that this world has failed to understand and basically chosen to ignore. So we're going to look at least many people in this world have chosen to ignore it and have not understood it. In verse 1, here we begin to see the story of the centurion Cornelius. And Cornelius was spelled in Greek beginning with a K because there's no C in Greek. Why is that of note? Well, Caesarea, the city, was also spelled with a K, so it was actually pronounced in Greek Caesarea, because it's named after the Kaiser, Caesar, same term in Greek. So we have some reference to it here. It's a reference to Caesar. Caesarea was named after Caesar, and in Greek that's Caesarea, was how they would have pronounced it. In World War I, of course, you had a Kaiser in Germany, and his title was also Kaiser Wilhelm II, was the one who was in control of Germany during the First World War. And that term Kaiser to them, which they also spell with a K, was also kind of a title like Caesar was to those in Rome. So Caesarea was actually Caesarea to the Greeks. A centurion was an interesting rank in the Roman army. It was actually the lowest rank that someone from the Senate or a wealthy family would be placed into. And this is one only because there was no other available higher ranks for them to be put in the military. If there were no higher ranks, there were never enough ranks for all the children of the senators and all the cousins and relatives and people who wanted to have some military experience and prestige of having that in their background. A lot of people wanted to be posted into the military, but at a higher rank than your common foot soldier. So that was a very common thing to take place. Senators and their sons were placed in higher ranks if those ranks were available, but there weren't always enough of them to go around. So the lowest rank they would be placed into, if you were wealthy or you were a son of a senator or whatever, was that of a centurion. The centurion was also the highest rank that an enlisted person could achieve by just simply entering the Roman army and working your way up through the ranks, so to speak. You could become a centurion, but that was as high as you could go, unless you had some type of political or a relative in a very, very high place in Rome. But that's as high as you could go. So centurions could become a centurion with no experience in the military, or they might have 15 or 20 years of experience by the time they achieved being a centurion. So that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on with this rank of centurion. It's something that's interesting. If they were wealthy and they had been placed in it for political reasons, then sometimes if that particular if that legion was going to actually have to go into combat, you wouldn't want a centurion in charge of men who had no experience as a centurion. So oftentimes they had what they call cohorts within the Roman army, and within each legion there were typically 10 cohorts. And a cohort was about 80 men. And so if you had 10 of those, you'd have close to 5,000 men in some legions, and maybe a little less than 5,000 in other legions as well. But the primary cohort, or the most important cohort, or was called a primi cohort, that was the leading cohort, and they had some very experienced centurions in that particular cohort. So oftentimes they'd substitute one of those experienced centurions for the inexperienced centurion, or they would kind of work with them if that particular legion had to go into combat in some way. And this cohort is kind of the forerunner of what we in many military organizations call a regiment. And regiments became part of many of your European armies and the United States Army and other places as well. But it would be about the equivalent of a regiment, except in the Navy. That would only be a company in the Navy. 80 people was typically company size in the Navy. That I know from personal experience. But most other forms, Air Force, Army, Marine Corps, work with regiments at that size. So that's a little bit of background on the centurion, just so that you have some of that. We don't know exactly which background Cornelius was from himself. However, the fact is he appears to be retired from the army at this point, which I suspect would require some years of service to have reached that point. Whether he was initially experienced as a centurion or not, we don't know. So even if he was placed as a centurion, he probably served for a number of years after that and gained that experience. But this particular centurion had come to know many Jewish people in his neighborhood, as well as being well respected by all of them. He was of the Italian regiment, it mentions, or the Italian cohort, you could say. So it may be mentioned because that might have been the first cohort of a particular legion, or the legion that was stationed in Palestine. We don't know for sure at the time. Historically, you might be able to research and find out what legion was there at that particular moment. But he may have retired well before that legion was assigned there. So we really don't know what legion he was connected to. But he was a true leader, even among the Gentiles, and certainly well respected among the Jews as well. God doesn't usually call the mighty and the noble, but this man was a very humble individual too. And, you know, I do not believe he was converted to Judaism as a proselyte. I could be wrong, but I think God wanted someone who was, how do I say it, cold turkey, a Gentile from the world, to demonstrate that he was now going to be working with Gentiles. If he had been a proselyte, then the Jews would have said, well, he's really a Jew. And there would have been kind of a lesser level of respect, I think, in the church to his being called at this point in time. But, you know, maybe I'm assuming things that are kind of behind the scenes that aren't really stated. But I think God wanted somebody who is definitely a Gentile from out there in order to demonstrate his will that he's going to be taking the church and the truth to the Gentiles now as well. So, in verse 2 of chapter 10, this says a lot about him. He feared God, and his household respected him, and he also, he feared. He was a respected and respectable person. He was generous with all. He prayed to God always, which is an interesting phrase. In Greek, it doesn't say that he prayed to God always. It says he made his petition to God in all things. In other words, he prayed about every kind of issue and every type of problem and every type of thing that he was confronted with in life, and about others. So his prayer was pretty much about everything, but it doesn't mean he was praying all the time. It just means his prayer was well distributed, shall we say, over many subjects and many areas, and, you know, maybe his own needs, but also the needs of people around him. So he prayed a lot, but not specifically all the time, but he prayed about many things. in life, things that affected him, things that affected people around him. And he talked with God regularly, something we all need to be doing. In verse 3, now, I don't know about the ninth hour of the day. It would have been a time probably that many Jews would probably be engaged in prayer. The ninth hour of the day would have been probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that was a typical time for many to have been praying. So perhaps he was praying and saw this vision, seeing an angel coming to him here in verse 3 and calling Cornelius. And interesting, after Cornelius says, what is it, Lord? Or, I'm here, what do you need? And the angel responds that his prayers have been heard. It's likely that that's what Cornelius was doing when the vision occurred. In other words, he was in prayer at that point in time, and the angel acknowledged it to him here. It doesn't say he was praying, but you get the impression because of the angel's response and the time of the day, it's likely he was in prayer. And it says a memorial is something, that we, to be remembered. His prayers have come up as a memorial to God. So God remembers Cornelius' prayers and his generosity, something we might ought to consider ourselves as well. In verse 5, then the angel gives instructions to Cornelius, a man not used to taking orders so much, or maybe I should say a man who is used to taking orders, because centurions received their orders, and they passed those orders on to the ones who served them. Why should, Cornelius's reaction was not, why should I do that? His reaction was clearly, what do you want me to do? I better send for Simon Peter. That's exactly what I need to do. So that's what he responds with. And in verse 6, he's living with, he's told that he's living with Simon the Tanner, whose house is by the sea in Joppa. And he will tell you what you must do. Now, if he was not used to receiving orders, he might say, well, why do I have to do that? But obviously, Cornelius is someone who takes orders and gives orders. And actually, the phrase in Greek in the King James and New King James, this one will tell you what it is necessary for you to do. That would be the most literal translation of what it says in Greek. At the end of verse 6. It's not in the majority of the Byzantine texts, however. It's only in a few of them called the Textus Receptus, or basically the Greek text from which we get the King James and the New King James from. But it's not in the majority of all the other Byzantine texts. So it's something, whether it was added or not, or whether it's original, I have no idea. I can't tell you. But it's in some Byzantine texts and not in the others, but it's in the primary Byzantine texts that come to the King James and the New King James. In verse 7, we see here Cornelius had household servants and even a pious soldier who remained with him. It indicates among others as well, so there may have been more than one soldier there. So it's possible that maybe more than one retired with him, or these were simply friends that he had had and known when he was in the army. And maybe some of them retired with him. So maybe some he was helping to retire because maybe they didn't have the funds to do so. He sent them to seek out Peter. And in verse 8, so he explains what happened and what he wants them to tell Peter, and he sends them on their way to find him. Then in verse 9, before the servants get there, God's timing is so precise, right on time. Just before Peter needs to know what these people are here for, Peter gets a vision to find out why these people are going to be arriving, or he gets a vision that kind of explains what's about to happen. And so Peter sees this vision while he's on the housetop at Simon's home. It's interesting, when you're on the housetop, and it's noon, another one of those typical times that people might be praying. Again, maybe Peter was in prayer, you know, as God begins to give him the vision. And in verse 11, here's what he sees in his trance or the vision that he's given. Heaven is opened, and this object that's bound at the four corners, kind of like a sheet, descending down to him, and it has all kinds of animals and creatures and creeping things and birds and whatever in it. And then in verse 12, now the sheet held all kinds of these things and creatures, and in verse 13, he hears a voice saying, Peter, rise, Peter, eat, kill and eat. Rise, Peter, kill and eat. And if you remember, the last person who offered Peter miraculous food, when was the last time Peter had miraculous food, so to speak? Right at the end of the book of John, Christ was standing on the beach. They were out in the fishing boats, hadn't caught anything. And Christ said, dip the net in on the other side of the boat. And there were so many fish, he couldn't pull it in. They were afraid they were going to break the net. That's the last time he had miraculous food. So what's Peter probably thinking as this is happening? He is seeing something miraculous again. Where do these miraculous things come from? He knows who's delivering the sheep. So Peter responds in verse 14, not so, Lord. You know, I can't, you know, I've never eaten anything common or unclean. There's a definite transition between the two. Yet translators will take the word common and unclean and they stick them together, and sometimes you don't know which word it actually is in Greek that's underlying the phrase. They'll just say everything is unclean or everything is common. But they won't usually separate the words. But at least here, you get to see both words in the same sentence. And if you remember, Peter responds, not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean. This is a very important statement. Peter's never done this. Why has he never done this? Well, because he knows that the Bible says you don't eat things that are unclean. And he, as a Jew, does the best he can to keep himself from being defiled by things that are common. Some foods are common, some foods are unclean, and there's a distinction between them. They are not different names for the same thing, the way translators oftentimes lump them together. In Jewish culture, they were very different. Common actually comes from the word koine or koinon in Greek, and it means common. Koine is the common Greek language of the New Testament. It's called Koine Greek, the common Greek. And unclean is actually akathartos. Kathartos is clean. Akathartos, if you put an A on the front of it, is unclean. We do that in English all the time, too. If you want to negate something like moral, amoral, we stick an A on the front of the word, and it negates the word. Kathartos is something healthy or clean, but akathartos is unclean, and we get our word cathartic as being something that's healthy or clean or good for you, so to speak, from it. Putting an A in front of things obviously negates them, as I said before. I distinguish this statement for you because people in this world like to use several verses in chapter 10 and 11 to show that Christ cleaned foods and you don't have to worry about anything unclean anymore. When Christ died, all of that Old Testament stuff is gone. That's the way they view it in many cases. In fact, I don't know too many Protestants today who would say otherwise. Most of them do eat unclean things because they figure that Christ has cleaned all of those things and they don't have to worry about it. In fact, we even have a translation, the NIV, if you look at Mark chapter 7, I think verse 22 or 21, somewhere right in there. In an NIV, it will actually have a statement in parens that says, by this Christ cleaned or made pure or made clean all foods. That's not in the Greek. That's not in the Bible. But the NIV decided that's what Christ did, so, you know, that's what they translated. But Christ, you know, when Christ died, did not necessarily do away with the Old Testament. Now, it did away with the sacrifices, because his sacrifice now, and has always, superseded the sacrifices in the Old Testament. But that's something, I think maybe it's somewhere between verse 19 and 20-something, maybe in Mark chapter 7, if you want to look at it. That we explain that, I think, in our booklet on clean and unclean foods. That verse is explained there. But translators today don't worry about the technical aspects of what's common and what's unclean. And we're going to see that you have to understand the difference between the two as you look through chapter 10 and 11, seeing what Peter's doing. You know, they translate them as though, you know, unclean foods are no longer unclean because they assume Christ has cleaned them, which is nonsense. But remember that Peter says here, I have never eaten anything common or unclean. Now, why is that? Well, because Peter's still keeping the food laws that we find in Leviticus 11 and Leviticus 14, or Deuteronomy 14. There are different places where it's listed, but, or maybe it's Leviticus 11 and 14, I think. Now, the Jewish principles regarding what is common are another matter altogether. Sometimes there's good reason, sometimes it's just strict tradition among the Jews. So if you have a freshly cooked turkey in your Jewish kitchen, and while you are out of the room, your dog or your cat goes in and bites a chunk off of the turkey, a strict Jewish kitchen would have to throw the turkey out. It's been defiled, it's become common, so we throw it out. Now, how many of you would throw out a whole turkey because the dog got a bite off of it or the cat got a bite off of it? You might cut out a little piece of the turkey and throw out some of it, but you wouldn't throw the whole thing out. And that's this concept of common, sometimes that people don't understand. But to the Jews, you know, it became common. If you, in a strict Jewish kitchen, you can't have any milk products with meat products. You can't mix them in any way. They have to be completely separate. And a fully Jewish kitchen would require you have a complete set of platters and you know, spoons, forks, you know, everything, one for dairy products and one for non-dairy, you know, for meat products. You'd have to have a whole separate set of items to do those things. But that's this concept of common to the Jews. The Jews were not to eat with Gentiles. That was another aspect of this common process. If you eat with Gentiles, you've been made common. If you even enter into their house, even if you don't eat, you have defiled the common laws of the Jews of the day. And so it's important to understand the distinction here as we go on in the chapter. In verse 15, now the angel or voice responds to Peter and says, what God has cleansed, call not thou common. Again, this word common, but he doesn't say common or unclean. He just simply says common. And that's the important part of the lesson here, is because we're dealing with Jew versus Gentile and tradition versus Gentile, or Jewish tradition versus Gentile. And that's something that we have to understand about why God is going to begin to work with Gentiles. Not because they are unclean, but because they are, in the Jewish mind, common, but they really aren't common to God. And that's a Jewish tradition. So we're going to see that as we go through it. What God has cleansed, and in this case he has cleansed the Gentiles, and he uses the word cathartos here, in the past tense, and the Greek word, you know, here is a use of cathartos, or clean, or healthy, or cleansed. You must not call common. So those Gentiles are not to be classified as common. And the angel or God doesn't use the word unclean here in response. only the word common. Because that's the lesson for Peter. God knows foods that are unclean are still unclean, but he wants to get this concept of common straightened out once and for all, as far as the church is concerned. In verse 16, and for extra emphasis here, God has the vision and the sheet lowered three times to Peter to convey the significance of what he's trying to teach him. Sometimes God repeats things three times. When he does that, you have to pay extra attention. He's really trying to get through to us, so to speak, when he does it three times. And we see that even Peter hasn't gotten the full message here, when a short time later we find the Apostle Paul having to correct Peter and other disciples when it came to associating with and having contact with the Gentiles. Look at Galatians chapter 2 and verse 14. You'll see it right there. Paul has to correct Peter because Peter was treating the Gentiles as common. So it took Peter a while to get the lesson here fully. And we're left with the understanding that Peter said no to the sheet three times too. No, I have never eaten common or unclean. And he must have said that three times. And we knew, or at least we know that. So the lesson continues on into chapter 11. We're going to see Peter beginning to understand what's happened in chapter 10, in chapter 11. And now we find Peter wondering what the vision is all about. He's still kind of confused, and the men from Cornelius show up at the front door of Simon's house and start knocking, so to speak. Verse 18, they knock and they ask for Simon, called Peter. Was he lodging here? And in verse 19, Peter thought about it, and he still does not understand. So the Spirit of God intervened in his thoughts and said, three men are here seeking you. And then in verse 20, the Spirit says, arise and go with them, not doubting, because that's what you're doing right now. You're doubting about this whole vision that you just had. Go with them, not doubting. Pretty clear command. For I have sent them. So Peter is still doubting, even though the vision, you know, has happened. He's clearly confused. All of his life, he's obeyed the clean and unclean and common laws throughout his whole life. And so Peter asks the men, what have they come for? He's trying to figure out what's the connection here to all of this. And in verse 22, they explain to him about Cornelius, a centurion, being told by the angel to send me, looking for her, to send these individuals looking for himself to go to the centurion's home. And in verse 23, Peter lodged them there for the night. It was probably getting late by that point in time as he finds out what it is they want. And they want to get an early start in the morning with some brethren who obviously want to go, who are in this area with Peter too. So undoubtedly some of the brethren in Joppa were worried about Peter going to a Gentile centurion. I mean, what is Peter thinking? That he's going to go into a common house. So there's a little concern about what's going to happen to Peter when he goes to see a Gentile centurion. Verse 24, and we find Cornelius was waiting for Peter, and he meets him as he first apparently enters Caesarea, although it may be that his house was on the edge of Caesarea, I don't know, or on the edge of the sea. I'm not sure which area they got to first. Maybe his house was the first one in Caesarea, I don't know. But Cornelius was anxious and he met him. And so they probably proceeded to his home, which may have been right there where they met him, where Cornelius had gathered friends, family, associates, and others. Isn't that kind of the way God first called us? When you think about it. Talk to all your friends, talk to all your relatives, and try to explain to them all of this new truth that you found out and all of this calling, how wonderful it is, and why don't you understand? And we're not sure. And we tried to tell our relatives and our friends all about this new understanding that we had, and this particular incident, it worked quite well, only because God was calling quite a number of these people here at the time. Maybe a whole church full of people who knew Cornelius that God called all at one time. Verse 25. And here Cornelius is so emotional and so thankful Peter has come that he falls down at Peter's feet to worship him. And in verse 26, so Peter lifts him up and says, "Stand up, I also am a man, or I am also not to be worshipped." Verse 27, Peter is now somewhat surprised that so many have gathered in this man's home. And I suspect being a I'm guessing a wealthy centurion and one who's retired well, he has a pretty good-sized house. I mean, he's taken in other soldiers. He's got multiple servants. It's a pretty good-sized home, I suspect. So there may be quite a few people here that have gathered at his home. And in many ways, it's a ready-made audience for Peter. He's got an audience for his sermon. No doubt Peter had a sermon in his pocket, I'm sure, to be able to, no, I'm just kidding. He begins to talk about the whole concept of the gospel and Jesus Christ and all of those things, which pretty much any of us should pretty well have in mind any time that we're caught having to give a sermon. No, I'm just kidding. But obviously, anytime we have interface with people in this world and they ask us questions about what we believe and why, we should have some idea of how to answer. And then in verse 27, Peter's now a little surprised to see how many are here. And in verse 28 and 29, Peter has figured out the vision in this verse at this point. Maybe it was on the long walk over to Cornelius' home. God finally got through to him, or even with all the Jewish tradition he'd had and been taught. Notice he says, "I should not call any man common or unclean." So the vision is connecting with Peter here. He's now discovered why he's had the vision, because he's now going to the Gentiles. Even after God calls us, sometimes it takes a while for us to get past some of our pre-existing conclusions or ideas about life before we finally see things the way God wants us to see them. And Peter probably already knows what he's been sent for, because he probably sensed that God was calling these individuals. But to be polite and not make assumptions, he asks Cornelius, "Why have you sent for me?" I think he already knows, but he wants to hear it from Cornelius. And so in verse 30, Cornelius tells him his story about his prayer and the vision and the angel coming to tell him, you know, that he is to go and find one Simon called Peter. Perhaps Cornelius retells the story here for all their benefit. And it's possible, not likely, that Luke might have been one of the Gentiles even present here who maybe recalls this incident. And that's why he's writing it into the book of Acts, as we see. I don't know that that's a fact. It doesn't say that Luke was present, but he might have been. And if that's the case, then Luke begins to get firsthand experience, so to speak, in what he's about to put into some of his writings later, into the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles, as it's called, or the Praxis Apostolis, I think is the Greek word for Acts of the Apostles, as it is in Greek. Verses 31 and 32, so Cornelius gives the whole story right back to us in these two verses. And then in verse 33, Cornelius concludes that he is overjoyed that Peter has come immediately. And here's the interesting part. Cornelius tells him, "We are all here prepared to hear all the things God has commanded you to tell us." So Peter's really now on the spot. So the impetus is now on his shoulders to explain this whole concept of the gospel and what God is doing to everyone here. And so they all look to him to say it, and obviously God inspired him to give the sermon that he now gives, if that's what we call it, a sermon. Verse 34, Peter begins by expressing the wonderful truth that he has just learned about God showing no partiality in dealing with people of every nation. As a Jew, he'd probably been taught all his life that because he was a Jew, or was he was Jewish, he was special, and God was only working with the Jews as his special people, truly Israel, but he was mainly concerned about the Jewish tribe. It might also be difficult for us to understand what God, may and probably is working and doing in churches of God, various churches of God today too. But God is working in different areas. If you look at John 10:16, what does Christ say in John 10, verse 16? Let's go look at it. Is God dealing with others? John 10, verse 16. Got to lean over here toward the mic. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold. Them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd, ultimately. So there are others not of this flock. Are there other churches of God? Yes. Could they be of other flocks? Probably. Does that mean that God isn't working with them? No. It just means that there are others that God is working with. Maybe outside of what we consider to be our general flock. That's true. Okay, Verse 35. Verse 35. Here Peter gives us a great summary verse of how God treats all peoples. Those who fear and respect God and walk in righteousness or walk justly, or we might say are walking in his ways, God accepts or will work with those who do. And then in verse 36, the word, perhaps capitalized, capital W-O-R-D, maybe, which God sent to the children of Israel, preaching peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. I believe Peter is again acknowledging that Jesus is the word, as it's stated in John 1, verse 1, whom God sent to preach peace, who is the Prince of Peace, through a human Jesus Christ in this world. One of the verses, and I'm trying to remember, I think it's in Hebrews, it calls God the Father the King of Peace, I think, doesn't it? Didn't we read one close to that? And Jesus Christ is the Prince of Peace. That's interesting. I just noticed that. Maybe I'm mistaken, but I think that's... Yeah, I think it is. Anyway.
13 verse 20.
Of
may the God of peace who brought up our Lord Jesus.
Yeah, the God of peace who brought up, not the King of Peace, but the God of peace. Okay. Chapter 13, verse 40?
20.
Verse 20, okay, of Hebrews. I was just thinking about that. He had mentioned that, and I just associated the two here while I was looking at my notes. So, what could Peter say that would be more glorious than that, really? When you think about it, God sent him to preach peace to this world. Verse 37, that word you know, which was proclaimed throughout all Judea and began from Galilee after the baptism which John preached. So Peter is beginning right at the very beginning of the gospel message that Jesus preached in his sermon to Cornelius and the company here. And then in verse 38, actually verses 38 to 41, I'll kind of summarize them together. And it's good for us to kind of hear this very basic sermon all over again in Peter's words this time. If you begin those three, four, five verses here, it might be good for us to pay close attention to his sermon here, though we may have heard it a dozen different times in a dozen different ways over the years. Because this might be the outline for your first sermon during the millennium. Have you ever thought about that? What's God going to have you doing with people in the millennium? These people will have no preacher, at least none that want to be acknowledged as one, even though there might be preachers there who've lived in this world. They aren't going to want to be known as false teachers, so many of them may deny that existence. So who's going to preach to all these people in the millennium when Jesus Christ first returns? Who's going to help them? Who's going to teach them? You and me. Well, at least you, anyway. I don't know what I'll be doing. So, that's something to think about. You know, when Christ returns, these few verses here, verses 38 to 41, you want to write down in your head permanently. These are maybe where I should start if I begin to preach during the millennium. There are a lot of people who will be ready to listen at that point in time. And so as a spirit being, you can commit this outline to memory, put it in your own words during the millennium and use it as your opening comments, especially since this outline has been already given approval by God and was probably inspired by him for Peter to give. So you have virtual approval right here in the scriptures. Verse 42, indeed, Peter says, he, Jesus, commanded us to preach and testify that he is the one ordained by God to be the judge of the living and the dead. There's been a tremendous amount of authority given to the Son in order to finish his mission and prepare all peoples on this earth for the coming of the Father. And it is to proclaim to the people, not just a personal evangelism to individuals. It is the word keroso in Greek, distinct from euangelizo, which is to evangelize. It's the word to preach or proclaim. In other words, to stand on your soapbox and to shout it out and to give it to all peoples or to big crowds or whatever. But that's the kind of individual who's sent by God or sent by the church to do that. And that word keroso is used here. Verse 43, to him all the prophets and witnesses that through his name, whoever believes God, whoever believes God obviously calls, can receive remission of sins, the opening of the way to eternal life, to God's plan. And that is the forgiveness or the remission or taking away of sin. Verse 44, and as Peter really gets wound up in his sermon here, God causes the Holy Spirit to fall on all of those who are hearing this word being preached here. That's quite a few people. God is calling all at once, all in one place. Of course, God isn't limited by how many people he can call at one time. But this man had, I suspect, a massive house here, and there were quite a few people being called, and he was well respected when he left the army. Verse 45. Now remember, there are a number present of the brethren of Jewish extraction from Joppa that came with Peter. What are they thinking now as they see Peter preaching this to them? What's going on in their heads? They are probably swimming with what is happening here. And they're amazed at what God is doing. And pouring out of his Holy Spirit on the Gentiles too. Is God a respecter of persons? Obviously not. So obviously every human being is going to be given an opportunity to be called by God and have their mind opened by him to his word. And that word, obviously the Bible, but Jesus Christ is also that word. In verse 46, God would not give the Spirit to the Gentile Christians with any less flair, with any less color than he did for the Jewish Christians. And so we see miracles of tongues being given here as they receive the Spirit. Would God call them and not give them the same kind of soiree, I'm looking for a word here. Would God do anything less for the Gentiles? Obviously not. And it's interesting that God chose the miracle of tongues again here. It seems as if they were unable to speak with them or understand them after this event was over. Then they were a brief phenomenon. I don't know whether the tongues lasted or whether they were just for this particular event. Who knows? Maybe they lasted And maybe it was a benefit because many of these first being called Gentiles were going to become preachers themselves later to the Gentile world. We don't know. However, if he gave some the gift and it lasted, then the miracle would serve the purpose of spreading the gospel and the word even further among other Gentiles. So maybe that was part of it, or part of the reasoning there. Did God do so? I don't know. There's no record that says that the tongues lasted or didn't last. So I don't know. The record of Acts doesn't specifically say. It would be interesting to know, an interesting question to ask Luke, did they last or not, if he would know. Verse 47. I'm just about out of time here, so I'll maybe finish up verse 47 and then quit. Peter seems to be playing a little bit of catch-up here. God is doing things faster than he seems to be able to keep up with, which is his privilege. God can move as fast as he wants to move, and sometimes we're just struggling to keep up. Normally, people are baptized first, then they receive the Holy Spirit, but God's moving really quick here. And so he asks, can anyone forbid water that these should not be baptized? In other words, we've already skipped one major step in the process. Let's go back and play catch-up quick. And so he does, maybe too, it was a request to the host and the hostess here of the home to find a place for them to be baptized. Maybe they had a pond or something. You know, a lot of times in those large homes, they had a large open area that was kind of a garden and who knows what all. That may be where the group is gathered. There may have been a fountain. Who knows? I don't know how wealthy he was or how big the home was. So that's a possibility that they may have been looking for a place to baptize people. One of my commentaries says about this interest or this particular incident. It says, "Thank goodness Peter was a man who made things happen." Oh, I don't think it's Peter that's making things happen. I think it's God that's making things happen here at this point. Peter is just playing catch up, trying to catch up with what God's doing. He's struggling to hang on as things move past him at velocity. So, verse 48, so Peter sees to it that they were baptized, and Peter is asked to remain a few days, probably to preach and to explain the scriptures each day, to give them a good start on this way of life that they were about to be challenged with and begin to walk in. And that's probably a good place for me to quit at the end of chapter 10. Any questions about chapter 10? Okay, great stuff. We see, we'll see Peter beginning to understand further about this whole concept when we get into chapter 11. So, and we'll leave that for next time. All right, thank you for coming.